much greater chance of success. This is the kind of operation that neurosurgeons love. A technical challenge with a profoundly grateful patient at the end of it if all goes well. I had seen the patient in my outpatient clinic a few days earlier. He had been suffering from severe headaches for the last few months. He was a 40-year-old accountant, with a head of curly brown hair and a slightly red face that made him look continually embarrassed. As we spoke, I felt embarrassed in return and became self-conscious and awkward as I tried to explain the gravity of his illness to him. Only later did I realize that he had a red face because he was polycythemic. He had more red blood cells in his blood than normal, since his particular tumor can stimulate the bone marrow to overproduce red blood cells. "Do you want to see your brain scan?" I asked him, as I ask all my patients. "Yes," he replied, a little uncertainly. The scan made the tumour look as though it was full of black snakes, phlovoids, produced by the blood rushing through the potentially disastrous blood vessels. I viewed these on the scan with enthusiasm, as they meant that a challenging operation was in prospect. My patient looked cautiously at the computer screen in front of us as I explained the scan to him, and we discussed his symptoms. "I've never been seriously ill before," he said unhappily, "and now this." "I'm almost certain it's benign," I told him. "Many brain tumours are malignant and incurable, and I often have to overcome my instinct when talking to patients with brain tumours to try to comfort and reassure them. I have sometimes failed to do this and have bitterly regretted being too optimistic before an operation." I told him that if I thought it was benign, it almost certainly was. I then delivered my standard speech about the risks of the operation and how they had to be justified by the risks of doing nothing. I said that he would die within a matter of months if he did not have the tumour removed. "Informed consent sounds so easy in principle. The surgeon explains the balance of risks and benefits, and the calm and rational patient decides what he or she wants. Just like going to the supermarket and choosing from the vast array of toothbrushes on offer. The reality is very different. Patients are both terrified and ignorant. How are they to know whether the surgeon is competent or not? They will try to overcome their fear by investing the surgeon with superhuman abilities." I told him that there was a 1 or 2% risk of his dying or having a stroke if the operation went badly. In truth, I did not know the exact figure, as I have only operated on a few tumours like his. Ones as large as his are very rare. But I dislike terrorising patients when I know they have to have an operation. What was certain was that the risk of the operation was many times smaller than the risk of not operating. All that really matters is that I am as sure as I can be that the decision to operate is correct and that no other surgeon can do the operation any better than I can. This is not as much of a problem for me now that I have been operating on brain tumours for many years, but it can be a moral dilemma for a younger surgeon. If they do not take on difficult cases, how will they ever get any better? But what if they have a colleague who is more experienced? If patients were thinking rationally, they would ask their surgeon how many operations he or she has performed of the sort for which their consent is being sought. But in my experience, this scarcely ever happens. It is frightening to think that your surgeon might not be up to scratch, and it is much easier just to trust him. As patients, we are deeply reluctant to offend a surgeon who is about to operate on us. When I underwent surgery myself, I found that I was in awe of the colleagues who had to treat me, though I knew that they, in turn, were frightened of me, as all the usual defences of professional detachment collapse when treating a colleague. It is not surprising that all surgeons hate operating on surgeons. My patient listened in silence as I told him that if I operated upon 100 people like him, one or two of them would die or be left hopelessly disabled. He nodded and said, "What almost everybody says to me in reply to this, well, all operations have risks." Would he have chosen not to have the operation if I had said the risk was 5% or 15% or 50%? Would he have chosen to find another surgeon who quoted lower risks? Would he have chosen differently if I had not made any jokes or had not smiled? I asked him if he had any questions, but he shook his head. Taking the pen I offered him, he signed the long and complicated form, printed on yellow paper and several pages in length, with a special section on the legal disposal of body parts. He did not read it. I have yet to find anybody who does. I told him that he would be admitted for surgery the following Monday. "Sent for the patient?" I asked as I entered the operating theatre on Monday morning. "No," said Hugh Nock, the ODA, the member of the theatre team who assists the anaesthetist. "No blood." "But the patient has been in the building for 2 days already," I said. Hugh Nock, a delightful Korean woman, smiled apologetically but said nothing in reply. "The blood's had to be sent off again at 6 this morning," said the anaesthetist as she entered the room. "They had to be done again because yesterday's bloods were on the old EPR system, which has stopped working for some reason because of the new hospital computer system, which went live today. The patient now has a different number, apparently, and we can't find the results from all the blood tests sent yesterday." "When can I start?" I asked, unhappy at being kept waiting when I had a dangerous and difficult case to do. "Starting on time, with everything just right, and the surgical drapes placed in exactly the right way, the instruments tidily laid out, is an important way of calming surgical stage fright. A couple of hours at least." I said that there was a poster downstairs saying that iClip, the new computer system, should only keep patients waiting a few extra minutes. The anaesthetist laughed in reply. I left the room. Years ago, I would have stormed off in a rage, demanding that something be done. But my anger has come to be replaced by fatalistic despair, as I have been forced to recognize my complete impotence as just another doctor faced by yet another new computer program in a huge modern hospital. I found the junior doctors in the theater corridor, standing around the reception desk, where a young man was sitting in front of the receptionist's computer with an embarrassed smile. He wore a white PVC tabard, on which was stamped in friendly blue letters, on both back and front, "iClip Floorwalker." I looked questioningly at Fiona, my senior registrar. "We've asked him to find the blood results for the brain tumour case, but he's not succeeding," she said. "I suppose I should go and apologise to the poor patient," I said with a sigh. I dislike talking to patients on the morning of their operation. I prefer not to be reminded of their humanity and their fear, and I do not want them to suspect that I, too, am anxious. "I've already told him," Fiona replied to my relief. I left the junior doctors and returned to my office, where my secretary, Gail, had now been joined by Julia, the bed manager, one of our senior nurses, who is responsible for the thankless task of trying to find beds for our patients. There are never enough beds, and she spends her working day on the telephone, frantically trying to cajole other bed managers elsewhere to swap one patient for another, or to take patients back from the neurosurgical wards so that we can admit a new one. "Look," said Gail. She pointed to the welcome screen for iClip that she had opened. I saw bizarre names such as mortuary discharge, reverse decease, or birth amendments, each with its own colourful little icon, flash past as she scrolled through the long list. "I have got to select from this insane list every time I do anything at all," said Gail. I left her to her struggle with the strange icons and sat in my office doing paperwork until I was telephoned to be told that the patient had finally arrived in the anaesthetic room. I went upstairs, changed, and joined Fiona in the operating theatre. The patient